all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or by going to veteransradio.net, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.net. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. We also want to thank our latest national sponsor, Veteran Lending Council. It is a community dedicated to educating lenders, realtors, and veterans on the VA Home Loan Benefit Program. You can check them out on Facebook and other social media outlets. We're going to start off today, really, because this has been so much in the news. We've talked about it once before with one of our guests, but I want to talk about urban warfare and more specifically about what's happening in Ukraine and how that's kind of rewriting the rules for urban warfare. So we're going to talk to Army Major John Spencer, retired, who's a professor and educator in this space, has personal experience, and is going to give us some insights into kind of the rethinking and what's going on in urban warfare. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio John Spencer. John is a U.S. Army major retired. He is the chair of the Urban Warfare Studies at the Modern War Institute at West Point. He is a world's leading expert on urban warfare. He's got a new book coming out called Connected Soldiers, Life, Leadership, and Social Connections in Modern War. John, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thanks for having me. What an honor.
Well, we're thrilled to have experts like you come on. You have over 25 years worth of Army experience, and you've done a couple of combat tours in Iraq, both as an infantry platoon leader and a company commander. So we're bringing somebody to Veteran Radio listeners here who has on-the-ground experience and is a bit of a brainiac. You know, so, John, use simple words so that I can understand them.
I'm an old infantryman. It's going to be very simple.
Well, that's why we have the sound pushed up. You can't hear anything.
Yeah.
So let's start with this. You know, you spent now over 25 years in the military service, and you learn a lot of lessons through that if you, you know, pay attention. And that's kind of led to some views that you have on how to effectively build teams in ways that overcome distractions. Tell us sort of, hey, why did you have to write this book? Because it takes a lot of work. So, you know, there was something itching in you to get out.
Absolutely. So I wrote the book over years. It took me a while to write it. And it's really a memoir of comparing my time in 2003. So I was a part of the invasion in Iraq. And when I went to war, I jumped in a part of the 173rd out of Italy. It was very much what I thought war would be. You know, a band of brothers experience, not connected to the to home. You're writing letters on cardboard. You're forming these bonds, which you like you said, I'm a geeky academic, so I weave in kind of the history of war that we know and why soldiers fight. And the overwhelming answer through studies of many armies and many wars is that they fight for the people to their left and right. Well, as I joined the Army as a kid out of high school, and I quickly learned that is absolutely true. And then I went to combat and I learned like all the things that we believe in the books and the reading movies, it's all true about forming this cohesive small teams to where soldiers are willing to die for each other because they're friends and they love each other. But what I also learned is that doesn't just happen. So it's actually the research shows that, like I experienced, that happens when you not only experience hardship together, but you spend a lot of time together. So I went back to war in 2008 for another combat deployment, and the world had changed, not just the war in which I was fighting. So as Baghdad was unraveling in the civil war, but we were all connected to home. Writing letters was gone. Every night you could come home from whatever had happened in the battle or on your daily patrol, and you could reach back to home and talk to your loved ones and your families. So as I kind of went even more academic later in my career at West Point and watching cadets on their phone, I started to think about how the big difference between my first deployment and my second as the world changed, and militaries are just reflections of society, and how that was impacting this ability to form these connections, like the band of brothers. You know, if you're spending more time talking back home, but there's also, you're also learning about home unlike you could before, and home's learning about war like we all can do now. Like in Ukraine, we can watch the war in real time. And it really culminates for me as a, you know, military families experience military service with their service person. When I retired in 2018, I stayed home with our three kids and my wife went off to war. So now I was on the other end of that.
So that's 10 years later. 10 yeah. years after your second tour in Iraq, and you're going, wow, social media, this, you know, telephones and smartphones and the world's really changed. How does it feel 10 years later when you're the person at home, the anchor at home?
Yeah, so I tried to approach it, and this is the kind of the comedy, of course, that's the, I, thinking I knew better, wanted to protect my wife from all the stresses of home. And my wife, being the super soldier that she is, she wanted none of that. She wanted to know everything that was happening at home, every trial and tribulation of small kids and whatever it was. And I was trying to...
Let's face it, she didn't trust you.
Yeah, right? but there's... And I dealt with this as a company commander, right? So I would never have imagined it being at war and then finding out, you know, that a soldier's girlfriend is overdosing on medications and he needs to stay off the patrol to deal with it, because there is this immediate access to what's going on at home. That's the world that we will fight wars in the future. And we're only seeing on steroids in the Ukraine today is this, that the line between home and front or the battlefront or war, whatever word you want to use, is gone. There is no divide between the population, the families, and the soldiers fighting the wars for whatever reason the war fighting.
That's really, in a nutshell, what you're writing and thinking this through has brought you to, which is that line's dissolved, hasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. It's gone. I mean, it literally, you can try to control it if you wanted to, like take everybody's phones, take everybody's cell, you know, tablets, everything. That's just not the way the world works anymore. There's more, you know, in Africa, there's more cell phones than there are toilets. There's, you know, it's just not the way the world is today.
So there's the big question for you as a both military leader and an academic thinking about this is how do you overcome that distraction so that it doesn't impact the team, whether it be in business or worse in the military where it's life and death? How do you overcome the distractions?
Exactly. And that's what I try to do in my book, is try to show, and I made lots of mistakes, but show the things that I did, especially in 2008 when we were, for many reasons, we were a failing organization. I had to bring everybody back together, but we've done things in the military that we all know work, right? Like eating together, sleeping together in small, you know, getting to know each other. Those things lead to this cohesion that then translates into combat effectiveness. Now, where the research gets kind of wonky is that there is a difference between task cohesion, as in the whole group agrees on what the job is, and we can only do it together. And we'll only accomplish it if we do it together. And some people will say that task cohesion is more important than social cohesion. Like, I got to love you. I got to like you. In the military, I think that's reversed, but they're both important. So as a leader, you had to identify priorities. And this thing about cohesion had to be one of my top priorities in everything that I was doing.
And you talk about stuff that worked and didn't work. And I think that's part of how the book becomes impactful, is when you kind of get real and talk, yes, about the things that don't work. So many people, I'm only going to tell you about all the good stuff, but it's important to talk both ways, isn't it?
Absolutely. You have to, I appreciate that was the point of doing this through a memoir, through my own experiences, on showing my mistakes, showing the real world challenges. It's not, I didn't want to romanticize everything. I wanted to put it all in there. Even the stresses I was facing as a leader, which is a part of the team, and the things that I needed to do to control all of that. You know, you're not going to control everything, but it's really important about prioritizing what's most important.
And there are, and you talk about sort of, there are benefits to this blurring of the line or disintegration of the line with social media. Talk a little bit about the benefits.
Sure. So absolutely, you know, even when I was in 2003 with no connection, we all wanted to talk to home. Like, we yearned for a phone call or to receive a message. That's human nature. And that's what COVID really taught us, right? So COVID taught us that we can't just totally disconnect from our families and our societies and our communities and our groups, because that's not the way that humans work. Yes, you can do it for a short amount of time because you have to, but that's what I had to experience in war, was that there is benefits, and people do want to talk to their loved ones. And that there's huge benefits of that. And I watched that through my kids, you know, small kids that wanted to talk to mom, and that ability to talk to her daily was important.
And important to her, or important to the service member deployed as well. I mean, that
absolutely,
that boost goes absolutely both to the kids, but to the parent as well.
Yeah, so I got that a lot, you know, recently with Ukraine about morale, right? So troops' morale is so important, and it is such an important part of the equation on the will to fight. Sometimes people will replace morale with what they're actually meaning is cohesion and other things, but morale is that feeling which goes up and down, and there's all kinds of things that can lift it. But of course, hearing from your loved ones is a huge boost to soldiers' morale. We know that mail has always been and messages and you know, all of that comes from that. But it's a double-edged sword, right? So you're going to receive bad messages. And that's what I was experiencing in 2008. We did in 2003 too. There was a time lapse between an event and soldier on the mission, which is important. But this is a challenge for, I think, everybody in the, right? So whether you're a pro sports team and you're trying to give a motivational speech in a locker room and somebody's on their cell phone, there is an aspect of knowing when people are in their virtual environment and when they need to be connected. In order to form the connections that matter most, there are moments when, okay, we have to be together as a team in this family at this moment.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to drive home to folks, that, you know, there's got to be time for both, but there is time when you just have to put down, turn over, don't look at the smartphone and the social media. I want to ask about an issue, because you have this unique position of both being a active military member who's been deployed, but now as a retired having a spouse go off on a deployment. Talk a little bit of what you saw in terms of women in battle and the role that women soldiers end up playing, and how that impacts the team.
Yeah, so it's every team is made up of a complex social structure, and there are norms, and there are history of what that team does or doesn't do. And I, even in 2003, we had female medic embeds into our units, and every individual is an important thing. I grew up, 25 years as an infantryman, ranger, just not with female soldiers, not because of anybody's, it was just not at the time, not a part of it. I have from day one been a firm believer of full integration, as in every soldier performs the job, then there are no barriers. I taught at the U.S. Army's Ranger School, and the amount of female soldiers that have made it through that school and have proven themselves to be extreme warriors, I would fight with them any day. But now, of course, being a retired guy, watching my wife, we actually met in combat. We met in Iraq, and then later, dated and everything. But it is complex, just like any organization that has longstanding beliefs and all that. But that's why leadership is so important, and it has been from day one. Our militaries are so unique, as in they're they bring together so many walks of life, so many races, religions, and now sexes, that of course there are challenges, but they figure it out to be this fighting formation, which I'm extremely proud of and still am, because I still work with them.
Well, as you mentioned, it's complex, and I think we have to, the book explores the complexity, and we're talking to Major U.S. Army Major John Spencer, retired, who's written Connected Soldiers, Life, Leadership, and Social Connections in Modern War. It's coming out on the Potomac Book imprint. It is complex, Jen, and we can't expect a single answer to solve all these problems, whether they are teams in the military or teams in the business world. And I think that's it. That complexity is also what makes you a overall better organization, isn't it?
Absolutely. Diversity in thoughts, in experiences of that individual, if it's problem solving or you name it, absolutely, it makes you even more powerful. When you're, just like I talk about in the book, the world changes and so does organizations have to change. You can't hold on to everything, and some things you have to remember why you're doing them. And that's why, I point out like some of these things that we know, and I still do it. Even we do it in our family. Like I was talking about with the connections, we have dinner together as much as possible, because it is such a formative time where you're talking to each other that sometimes gets lost as things, the pace of the world increases.
Yeah. I want to come to another part of your specialty, if you will. John's a bit of an egghead. He has his Master's of Policy Management from Georgetown University. He's chair of the Urban Warfare Studies at the Modern War Institute at West Point. He's host of the Urban Warfare Project podcast. So, John, you mentioned a little bit about Ukraine and how we're watching some of this play out in real time, and it has a lot of impacts and connections to your work and studies, including that cohesiveness and the morale and the social media influence and how it relates to motivating the Ukraine troops in a different way than it's motivating the Russian troops. So as you watch the nightly news and what's going on in Ukraine, as somebody with an emphasis on urban warfare studies, what lessons are we learning?
Wow, there's so many, because this is the biggest thing since World War II that's ever happened. The biggest battles, the biggest war, on multiple levels. It really is the biggest thing since World War II, and threatens the global international order. As an urban warfare scholar, student, researcher, so I just returned less than 2 weeks ago from going into Ukraine as a, you know, as an egghead, as you say, to study the battle.
I'm smiling when I say that. It's with respect. No, I'm just trying to relate. I'm relating to all the enlisted guys for you.
Yeah. I started off enlisted. I mean, I definitely, I went into to talk to the fighters to understand how this very small force that was only supposed to last 3 days in the biggest battle for a country that's happened in a very long time in Kyiv at the beginning of this war, how they defeated Russia, right? They're one of the biggest militaries, supposed to be so powerful. I think that role of morale and information, access to information was critical, because it was less than a brigade, less than 3,000 actual military forces were in this capital city of over 3 million at the time Russia invaded. And Russia came, they came hard, they came fast. But in the urban terrain, there are so many advantages to being, to understanding the environment. It's being your city. And what the Ukrainians did was, one, every civilian that was of able body or had had prior military service grabbed a weapon, which they had established a system of a, kind of like an armory within communities, grabbed the weapon and met the Russians in their streets. And there are things they did that were very interesting, and I'll write about them now, like flooding their own rivers and blowing their own bridges so that they would funnel the Russians into these kill zones that then would be met with not just a few Ukrainian military forces with you know, nice weapons, but to be met with hundreds of Ukrainian civilians. So there's a bunch of smaller battles where the Russians just get destroyed, but through motivated military and civilians willing to fight for freedom, to right, not to live under dictatorship. Well, I think the interesting part to the kind of the social media and the electronics part is how this guy, this comedian who became president, is putting out daily messages from, I don't need a ride, I need bullets. You name the quote that are like Churchill, George Washington level inspiration, which is great, but then it gets fed to millions of people through their cell phones. I mean, there's a battle in Ukraine called the Battle of Mariupol, which is like almost like our Bastogne with the general answering nuts to the Nazis. They were able to talk to the president almost every day in this besieged city for like 2 months. That's the level of kind of change we see, this ability to dominate information and motivate your troops, not just with your messages going down the chain of command like we're used to, but these messages like Snake Island. As a kind of an academic, I know that sometimes these stories and these messages are more important than bullets. To raise your troops' morale, to keep people fighting. And that's what we've seen. It, really, the Ukrainians taught the Russians a masterclass of what Russians used to be good at, which was information warfare.
Well, and as a sort of an artillery guy, you got to be watching this and saying, you know, the Russian approach to use of its artillery and its view of urban fighting is blow up every damn building in town, much different than what kind of occurs or occurred in Iraq and Afghanistan, where it wasn't complete destruction. It was more block by block. There seems to me, at least, that, like a big difference there.
Huge difference. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the huge difference is that Russia, which is it's just crazy, will not follow a single law of war. I mean, from complete genocide of prisoners of war, from grabbing civilians off the street and tying their hands, but absolutely in their approach to urban warfare. And they just captured a city this week, a city of 100,000, and they destroyed 90% of the buildings. That's historic, because they will bomb with no care to if there's even possibility of there being enemy in those buildings, which is not with the laws of war that we follow, the U.S. military, although all wars, there's no bloodless war, and it's very destructive in urban terrain. But I can tell you, we were shooting at enemy forces, like confirmed locations. Well, Russians will really do things that we said never again, like carpet bombing. They're actually targeting civilians to cause the other side to have to deal with civilian casualties. Like taking a theater with kids written in giant letters all around the theater, and then they bomb that theater just to cause a catastrophe for the people they're fighting to deal with.
Yeah, it's a unique, disturbing, informative that we're watching this in real time with drone coverage and all sorts of things, so you can actually watch it for yourself and instead of being maybe filtered by what the media wants to show you. I suspect that you're going to have to rewrite the syllabuses at Urban Warfare Studies in the coming years after all of this, John Spencer.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so we're a part of this fight for sure. I mean, this is a fight for democracy, but Russia is also showing all its cards, right? So, of course, everything is going to be updated. Russia isn't as strong as we thought they were in all kinds of capabilities, from electronic warfare to robotics to artillery. So, yeah, of course, we're going to rewrite. But as an urban guy, I also say this is the strongest point in modern history where all roads lead to urban. Where are they fighting over? The urban terrain. We better get good at urban fighting against people like this evil regime.
And protecting urban areas. I think that's maybe where the big miss is here. There's maybe not enough protection around urban areas.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the best offense is a good defense.
Well, we're glad that U.S. Army Major John Spencer, professor, thinker, chair of the Urban Warfare Studies, has had a little time to talk to us here on Veterans Radio. I think you've given us insight into this change on social connections as well as sort of what you're seeing out of Ukraine. John, I really appreciate the extra time that you've given us. If people want to know more about what you're thinking, what you're writing, where you're going, what's a good way for them to stay connected with you?
Sure. So that's ironic. My book is called Connected Soldiers. But yeah, to stay connected with me, I have a website called johnspenceronline.com. I'm big on Twitter as at Spencer Guard, and really all over the social media, which is ironic because the book's about that.
Well, it all ties back together, and I'm glad we could do that. John, again, thanks for spending a little time with us today.
Thanks so much.
Now, you may be thinking that you've heard John Spencer before, and you may have. He's all over cable news. He's often called on to be a commentator, but we're able to bring him to you direct to Veterans Radio listeners. So we're glad to be able to do that. He gives you a on-the-ground perspective. And if you've been thinking that Russia's rewriting the rules on urban warfare, he's confirmed it. And if you've been thinking about, geez, the social media impact of this war and how it impacts troops and families, he's kind of also helped confirm those thoughts for you. So here's a few words from our sponsors, and then we're going to pick up another discussion, more upbeat discussion, about the community out there to help veterans' health and wellness. I'm Jim Fossone. I'm your officer of the deck today, and thanks for listening as we hear a few words from our sponsors.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit veteranscrisisline.net. Veteranscrisisline.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Dale and I always want to make sure that we thank our VSO sponsors, such as the Vietnam Veterans of America, Charles S. Kettles, Chapter 310 in Ann Arbor, Michigan, VFW Graf O'Hara, Post 423, and the American Legion, Post 46, also in Ann Arbor. We can't stay on the air without the help of a whole lot of sponsors. You can always go to our website at veteransradio.net, click on the sponsors or support VR links, and help us out a little bit. We also have some great swag. There's some new material on the swag store that you might find interesting as well. I know I just got the new white Veterans Radio hat for the summer. Very nicely constructed. I think you'll enjoy that and help us celebrate our 19 years of bringing you these kinds of stories. The next one's going to be really, as I said earlier, about more wellness and health and focused on Team Red, White, and Blue. I think this will give you a little insight into the value of that connecting of veterans. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today John Founce, a Lieutenant Colonel retired from the United States Army, spent 20 years serving his country, and recently retired. So we're going to talk about some things in the news. But John, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Jim, thank you so much. I'm just thrilled to be here.
What made you go to West Point?
I think the most immediate answer was my brother also had been there. He was a 1989 graduate. And so it was always in the back of my mind that I would consider perhaps going there. But also just my family has been a very veteran service oriented family. My dad had four brothers. They all served in the military. My mom had three brothers. They all served in the military. I had one uncle who served in World War II, one in the Korean War, and one in Vietnam. And so it was just something that my parents were exposed to and they thought was a very high and noble calling. And I saw how my family reacted to my brother's service. He served during the Desert Storm, and we decorated the house. We watched the news and we paid close attention to it. And it was a great party when he came home. And he always spoke highly of it, the Army as well as West Point. And he, like everybody else, said, it's really hard. It's really challenging. And I think I've always just been kind of drawn to anyone who likes to throw out a challenge or a level of difficulty. I just like to take it on.
Well, you never thought about going to the Naval Academy?
What academy? I've never heard of that.
Well, it's a long family service to the Army that the Founce family has, and that's wonderful. It's really amazing, and probably when you went in, you didn't expect to spend 20 years, I don't think.
I did not. I did not expect to spend that long. I remember even thinking hard about, 5 years was the, as it's still the requirement once you graduate. I thought, that's kind of long. I guess I didn't think 20 was long.
Well, and your, I don't believe, was your brother a career service member?
No. No, he got out at his 5-year mark and moved on.
Well, again, it's one of those things. You get these great jobs, you get these great people you work with on important issues, and 1 year rolls into the next, and you look up and say, hey, I really enjoyed the 20. But let's go back. Tell us a little bit more about your career in the infantry and ultimately into special forces and on to some other places after that. So give us the thumbnail sketch of this.
Certainly. Well, I graduated and was commissioned on the 2nd of June, 2021. So 21 years ago today.
There you go. Yeah, nice coincidence.
And, of course, the world changed greatly a few months later in September. And so I was in the Infantry Officer Captain's Career Basic course when that happened down at Fort Benning, Georgia. And things got, very interesting very quickly. I finished that up and graduated and went on to Ranger School, and then immediately reported to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, in the summer of 2002. And we immediately saw shortly after tensions building in the Middle East. And as war loomed in January, we got orders to go to Iraq as part of Operation Iraqi Freedom. And so I spent 8 months as a rifle platoon leader, during my time there at in Iraq, spending most of my time there in Baghdad, really as a 23-year-old kid trying to learn every day what I needed to be doing. It was a very daunting task for a young infantryman at the time. But, my platoon of 40 guys, we were all kind of doing it together.
Well, and that's what I want you to talk a little bit about that because, you're freshly minted out of the West Point. You're all of a sudden in charge of 40 men, and not just, hey, you know, making widgets on the line. This is life and death stuff. So one of the things the military really gives you is this early exposure to leadership, doesn't it?
Yes. It starts very early on. You're responsible for everything you do as a young cadet. And when you get further on at West Point, and I would later go back as a TAC officer doing the same things to other cadets, they try to put the onus of decisions on you and let you make it as a leadership laboratory should be. And so you get used to making those decisions, and you get used to making some bad decisions, and you get used to learning how to rebound or become a little bit more resilient toward those decisions. You're going to make bad ones. That's what things like Ranger School and the basic course are for. They're going to put you in situations where you're going to have to lose something no matter what decision you make. There is no perfect answer in these scenarios, because in those kind of situations, you got to sometimes have to figure out amongst all the chaos, you know, how to get out of the situation or how to get out of this environment as best you can. And I think everyone knew that. And everyone knew that there was a lot on my shoulders as well as theirs. And I think it fostered a lot of open communication. We were light infantry, but you really couldn't do that in Baghdad in order to cover down on our sector. So all of a sudden now we have vehicles. And we hadn't really even trained for that. I mean, the vehicles were just things that took us to the forest so they could drop us off before it started raining. And here we are trying to figure out new SOPs, new ways and TTPs to operate as a light infantry unit with vehicles inside an urban environment. And so I think just the openness that everyone had about we've got to put our heads together to figure out the best way to do this really built some trust amongst us and my squad leaders. And it was a daily occurrence. We sat down every day and just looked at ourselves and say, hey, how are we doing? We're doing good. All right. Anyone think we should be doing something different? And it led to some good conversations.
Well, you had multiple overseas assignments. So you were in Iraq, and I think it was 2003 and 4 overlapping. Tell us the other two that you had.
There was a second deployment to Iraq during their first elections, which was a very interesting time to be there to see them go out and vote for the first time to set their destiny. I also then would transition over to the Special Forces in 2005 and went to 3rd Special Forces Group out of Fort Bragg, North Carolina as well. And we did a trip to Tajikistan, training their border guards. They share a border with Afghanistan, and the opium was being transmitted between those borders pretty porously. So we were training up those individuals. We had 534 Tajiks with us. And just teaching them some border patrol maneuvers. And then 2009, my detachment, my Special Forces 12-man detachment went to RC East and partnered with the Afghan commandos. There was only 6 Afghan commando units in the entire country, and we were fortunate to get one of those. And they were tapped for the better training, better pay, and the more hazardous duties and missions. So we did operations all throughout RC East, which is the entire eastern side of Afghanistan. Pretty good.
John, for those who might not understand what Special Forces means in the Army, can you give them an explanation here for Veterans Radio?
Sure. So the United States Special Forces is the only unit authorized by Congress to conduct unconventional warfare. And we focus there a little bit on building up other nations. And what we were doing in Iraq and Afghanistan is what we call FID, which is Foreign Internal Defense. A Special Forces team is a 12-man self-sustaining team with highly skilled people in weapons, engineering, medical, and communications specialists, as well as intel specialists and some planning specialists like myself. And doctrinally, we're supposed to be able to train up to a battalion-sized level, which is why we had so many Tajiks and why I had an entire battalion of Afghans. And our job really is to work ourselves out of a job, as we say. We try to train them up to do their own planning, train them up to do their own rehearsals, equipment maintenance, logistics, and hopefully as we continue to build them up, we can take a lesser role back. That's our goal. We try not to be the face of the operation. We really try to push them forward and keep them in front. And it takes some specialized training to have that kind of patience, because sometimes you want to do things yourself, because it might be the easiest way to do it. But a special forces team is going to build up over time those skills inside that unit so they can walk away one day and no longer be needed, hopefully.
Well, and this fits into a little bit of what your areas of study were. At West Point, you obtained a degree in psychology, and you also graduated from Columbia University with a master's in organizational psychology in 2011. So this whole thinking about it and how to motivate people and organizationally and the psychology of all of that was sort of fit right into your role in these assignments, I would think.
Yes. In fact, it was President Eisenhower who was instrumental in bringing psychology and a few other disciplines to United States Military Academy when they were not existing. And I think he, of course, understood greatly the impact that leaders can have just by their presence and just by understanding who you're leading. The emotional intelligence perhaps was not necessarily always a well-defined term early on in those days, but he did a lot to push that. And now all the TAC officers that go to help train these 4,000 cadets at the United States Military Academy get that degree in organizational psychology through Columbia. They have a wonderful partnership and huge support. But that's because the entire goal was to help these individuals, again, make their decisions on their own and take ownership of those decisions. But each decision affects people so much differently that you've got to kind of have that flexibility and patience to understand that you're dealing with a different person and trying to meet them at their level of how they understand it, and to push them and find where they don't understand themselves, but to give them the support to go ahead and make those decisions and learn from them.
I'd like to change the subject pretty much completely here, John, if you don't mind, and turn our attention to what you're currently doing, but there's a lot of back history to how you ended up here. And in that regards, John is now in his civilian life. He has joined Team Red, White, and Blue on their staff as a special events manager. And remember now, John graduated from the military academy at West Point in 2001. He picked up his graduate degree, his master's in organizational psychology in 2011. But he also has connections that with the founder of Team Red, White, and Blue. So tell us a little bit about Team Red, White, and Blue. Let's start there.
Absolutely. Team Red, White, and Blue is a national nonprofit forging itself to become America's leading health and wellness community for veterans. It was started in 2010 by Mike Irwin, who had been the intel officer while I was serving in 3rd Special Forces Group for my battalion. And then he left to go to grad school in 2009 at the University of Michigan. And Team Red, White, and Blue has actually filed for paperwork right there in Ann Arbor. And Mike had experienced, you know, the transition of coming. He came straight from Afghanistan to the classroom.
And there's a cultural shock.
Yes. And, you know, one of the things I remember him telling me is, like, you know, 2 weeks before the class he was in, he was, you know, doing intelligence reports for people going into hazardous areas and then sitting there in the classroom, and for people to not, in his mind, to care as much about Afghanistan as he was caring about 2 weeks ago was making him frustrated and almost making him pull away from these people. And he realized that's the wrong way. I need to go toward these people. They're not doing anything wrong. They're just, they don't have the same kind of experience, the same kind of knowledge, the same kind of day-to-day interaction that Mike got to have or that I got to have. I experienced the same thing in 2010 when I left and went to Columbia. You know, I'm sitting there in one of the early days when someone says, oh, you're one of the individuals from West Point, and they want to talk to you about Afghanistan. And you want to come at it purely from a military standpoint, and she's coming at it purely from a diplomatic standpoint. And I'm realizing that I've had one lens of many on how to view this war. And she's got one lens. And how do we get that together? How do we share it? Well, in a good spot, in a good environment where we can build trust and build relationship and also, you know, work on community. And so initially, Team Red, White, and Blue's mission was enriching veterans' lives by connecting them to their communities through physical and social activity. It's to help people stay connected when they got out of the military. When you're in the military, you got PT every day. You got to wake up, you got to go, you got to work out, and you got to be there. That's your job. when it becomes an option for you and you're trying to transition to a new job and you're trying to work hard, you got a new house, you know, those kind of things can drop off. And we were seeing that a lot of people were sacrificing physical fitness, physical and mental well-being on the altar of transition, got to get this move made. And so early on, there was a started developing chapters. I mean, right now we're at over 200,000 members, almost 200 different chapters through the country, where it's just a place for people to come, whether a quarter of our members are civilians. And it provided a wonderful outlet as a huge part of our mission is to connect those people that might not have grown up in the military. Maybe they didn't have brothers and sisters or uncles that served, but they have questions and they don't always know where to turn. And sometimes that can be a difficult conversation, especially around days like Memorial Day. Like, how do you approach that? Well, the best way to approach that is to do something together. Get out and go for a run. There's something very connecting about a 5K goal, a marathon goal, taking those steps, forward progress, and it just leads to conversation. And it just leads to, you know, Mike would say exercise is the most underprescribed medication. These are the kind of things that we can do to let some things out, let off some emotional steam, and also at the same time, doing it with someone who's going to hold us accountable. So that's kind of the early days.
And what's sort of surprising to me when I went to the website, which is teamrwb.org, was the fact that 25% of Team Red, White, and Blue members are civilians. And it is that really shows this, while it's veteran centric and a way for veterans of a maybe younger, more modern era to get together and do things like runs, but you're also drawing in that bigger community. Can you tell us some, give us some more statistics? What percentage are men, women? You know, what campaigns do they come from? Where are they spread out around the country?
Yeah, so for our members, about 60% are a veteran, about 23%, a quarter are civilian. We still have about 11% active duty and 7% guard and reserve. It's about 60% male, 40% female. So, you know, a higher female percentage than what you'd see in the military. So it really does kind of draw to both. 51% are Army, 19% Air Force, 16% Navy, 13% Marine Corps, and then another percent for Coast Guard and Space Force as well. So we got all representations from all our services. We have about 1,000 of those members are what we call Eagle leaders. They've, you know, taken the next step to say, I don't just want to be a part of this organization. I have some more time or I have some more desire. I want to step up and be a leader. And that can be something as simple as, hey, I'm going to lead a run on Saturdays, or I'm going to be the guy who organizes going to trivia at a restaurant on Thursday nights and get everything together, get the table reserved, put the word out and get these people to come and join them and kind of just facilitate the interaction. And that's our skeletal structure right there. Those are the people that really hold us together. And then we use our ethos to kind of be the nervous system that really brings it all together. And that's passion, people, commitment, camaraderie, and those kind of things are what are central to what we're trying to achieve.
And this is really a different model than the old veteran service organization where you'd go to the VFW hall and have drinks or play cards or smoke. This is really a different model, isn't it?
Yes, I think intentionally. There was a great need, I think, at that time. When some of these other organizations were starting up decades ago. And there sometimes in some cases was important to have veterans only. That's, you know, who they were able to, who they needed to speak to. But as we saw going forward, the landscape changing with veterans coming in and spending numerous deployments in a short period of time, for years and years when there was no end in sight, and then going out into the community and integrating into 2/3 of veterans will go to a zip code they didn't come from, usually for a new job, maybe to go back to where their spouse came from. But, you know, in the Army, in the military, you have this welcome, like everyone's kind of rotating. So you're used to it. And as someone who just transitioned, now I even transitioned back to the same house I grew up in that I got from my parents. So It made it easy for me. But what I didn't realize was the effects on my wife and children. You know, for me, it makes it sense. They're going to go to the school that dad went to when he was growing up. But to them, you know, they don't have their friends anymore. And the kids at that school aren't like them. And in a military school, a third of the class is new because a third of the class's parents left last year. And they're used to that kind of transition and change up. My wife now had to come back here and, you know, she used to have a whole group of wives that it was almost like Insta friends. You just kind of got together and said, I'm new. You're new. Hey, let's do this together. Whereas some of these, you know, friends and spouse groups are kind of ingrained and set. Not that they're barriers to get into, but we're just not used to having to ask those kind of questions or do that kind of seeking.
Well, it's an issue we've talked about on Veterans Radio before, and we're talking to John Founce, who's the special events coordinator for Team Red, White, and Blue. And what you're hitting on, John, is something that in the military, you had a network that was a military network. Now that you're out in the civilian world or maybe in a new business after you get out, you have to build a whole new network of people in that neighborhood, in that community, and or maybe in that business industry that you're going into that you didn't have before because you spent 20 years in the military. And that's where Team Red, White, and Blue, I'm sure, helps keep a network together where you find people who have that experience in the military, but maybe also can become part of the network in the new community or in the new business. Do you see that happening?
Absolutely, all the time. And a lot of times when I was a chapter captain for Team Red, White, and Blue Sand Hills, when I left West Point, you know, I had been the Team Red, White, and Blue West Point chapter, and I got to the Sand Hills and I wanted to keep going with RWB and meet new people. And I just started going to events wearing my shirt or running around carrying a flag. And, you know, you find people saying like, oh, well, I wish I could join, but I wasn't in the military. I'm like, well, what do you do? I'm like, well, I'm a teacher or I'm a nurse or I'm an accountant. Like, hey, we all need those people in our lives. We got questions that we got to ask. We're new to this area. You've been here for a while. You have knowledge on the community. I might have knowledge on the veteran. And together, we're going to better understand one another and form that community that then becomes a place where you can come to when you are in need. And that's, I think, the ultimate goal in the end. When we talk about health and wellness for veterans, we're talking about having a community where they are able to get the mental or physical help they need, the accountability with a positive aspect of getting people out to go to those runs, or when a day doesn't go so well, to say, that's okay. You know, we're going to get it back up next time. I'll be there with you. And so we are learning that everyone has a role to play. And it doesn't really matter what your profession is. Really, it's just a matter of wanting to serve those that served and build a community that you want to be a part of.
That health and wellness goal of RWB fits right into that. But I want to draw a distinction again for this organization that I think is important because I think it's a more modern approach. This isn't about, you know, monthly meetings or biweekly meetings or anything like that, is it?
Nope. This is a revolving door. You can go in and out, and it's not just your community that you're a part of. We have an app that you can download on the App Store, Team RWB. Sign up. You can get into your chapter, and you can look for local events, and they're all listed there. All different kinds. You can filter it. Maybe I'm not a runner. I'm a hiker. I'm a cyclist. You can find those events. And then when I travel, I've used that opportunity to change my location and find out what's going on. I've done a marathon with the Richmond chapter, Hartford, Connecticut chapter, and I think a few other chapters, if I can think back to even some more. I just kind of put my name out there. I'm like, hey, I'm an Eagle. I'm a Team Red, White, and Blue Eagle. I see you got an event going on. I'd like to come out. Absolutely. It's just bringing those people in from those different perspectives. So that's kind of how they do it.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to get across. RWB is an event-driven community. It's get-out-and-do-something-driven community. And that fits right back into the role that you're playing now as a special events manager. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. The special events are defined as any of the external partners, organizations that want to have Team Red, White, and Blue as a charitable beneficiary. we have a range of things. Partner with the Marine Corps Marathon, where we get some bibs in exchange for raising some money and raising awareness about their partnership with us. We've got a lot of small 5Ks, 10Ks that just say, hey, I wanted to raise some money for someone. And I said, who should I do it for? And someone in our community said, oh, you got to talk to Joe, or you got to talk to Susan. And when I get these calls all the time that says, hey, I just learned about you guys, but someone wanted me to know that it would be put to good use to partner with you guys. And so what can we do? And then we'll usually just set up some kind of agreement where we try to promote their event. We put it in our app so that when you're searching for things, you might see the Dexter Ann Arbor run in there and say, hey, wow, this run is benefiting Team Red, White, and Blue. I'd like to choose this one and go out there and support them. And that's kind of why we view this community, where we're offering real life and also virtual events. The past 2 years have shown that that's going to be something that's going to be more part of our daily lives, even still today, for many reasons, but also just the idea that you can connect with people all over the country, that you can get on there. And I've done virtual yoga sessions where it's a live yoga session and I'm doing yoga with a bunch of different eagles. And sometimes you run into someone that you've seen before just there on the screen, but it's another way to get people back into being active and healthy in their lifestyle.
And as you've mentioned before, it's a 501c3 charity that's always looking for some financial help. Tell us a little bit about that and what the plans are for how that will expand Team Red, White, and Blue.
Sure. We, of course, are very excited for the $6 million donation that Mackenzie Scott gave and the trust and the challenge that she's given to Team Red, White, and Blue.
We really appreciate John Fonts spending a little time with us on Team Red, White, and Blue. You can check them out by going to teamrwb.org. Thanks for listening to Veterans Radio today. Check us out at veteransradio.net. Dale will be back soon from his R&R. And until next time on Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.